it's going down, and you're invited for what they selling. We ain't buying, there is no running, there is no hiding, there's only fighting or dying. It's going down, and you're invited for what they selling. We ain't buying, there is no running, there is no hiding, there's only fighting or dying.
It's Going Down is a digital community center from anarchist, anti-fascist, autonomous, anti-capitalist, and anti-colonial movements. Our mission is to provide an autonomous and resilient platform to publicize and promote revolutionary theory and action.
Go to itsgoingdown.org for daily updates. Check out our online store for ways to donate and rate and follow us on iTunes if you like this podcast.
I'm Tammy. I am an anarchist based in Hamilton, Ontario. I've been involved in stuff for over a decade, involved in different projects in the city, including the tower.
Yeah, my name is Dieter. Likewise, anarchist Hamilton. Been living here a long time. It's been really interesting living here this past couple of years and being kind of out of town more than I've been in town, but I still feel like it's this is my place.
We're going to be talking about everything that's been happening over the past couple of months, but I feel to really kind of tell the story, we first have to go back to what happened with the Lock Street riot, and kind of the partial backlash from the local business community and even politicians. And if you can just kind of take us back to that moment so we can kind of compare that to what's happening now. And
yeah,
for sure. It's been a long and interesting year and a half. So we hosted an anarchist book fair in March of last year. On the weekend of the book fair, there was like a night demo that took place, an anti-gentrification march that went down one of the more affluent streets in Hamilton that sort of held up as the goal of what like investors want the city to be. So I'm like, property destruction happened on the weekend. The number thrown around was like $100,000, but really unclear what the number was. But so that happened. And afterwards, the city of Hamilton kind of went a little hysterical for a couple months. Really like, really shook up the city. The reaction was really, really intense. There was like, lots like in city council talked about like anarchist terrorists. There was a period of time in which they were trying to make the Circle A hate crime symbol in the city. There was lots of sort of ridiculous articles in the media.
Tried to designate us a gang.
Oh yeah, tried to designate a gang. Yeah. scare pieces in the newspaper talking about like anarchists like hiding in bushes. So like some of the public parks like actually trimmed and cut down their like bushes. Just kind of that sort of thing.
It's always been like that in Hamilton. Like Hamilton is a town that overreacts. And a lot of the time that's interesting because it means you can just like prod them a little bit and just this like explosive reaction on the part of like often this like kind of gentrifying scene is what like makes the action effective. But this time it was just like so over the top and linked in with the far right that it was just like this period of time where it felt like we could just literally be killed and no one would care.
Yeah, it was definitely people. There were some fireworks that were let off during the demonstration, and there was lots of people talking about how the sound of fireworks made people like the downtown core felt like a war zone and that it was traumatizing and things like that. Or really intense, like people would be talking about like needing to skin anarchists alive kind of rhetoric. The space, the first location for the tower, got attacked several times by the far right. The windows got smashed once. Another time they got smashed and the space got broken into and actually trashed a little bit. On another weekend, a group of sort of local and regional far-right folks, like, came to sort of confront the space. There was, like, a scuffle and a fight that broke out outside of it. Stuff like that was kind of ongoing for a bit.
And then the other half of the reaction too is just how anarchists like in Hamilton and the surrounding area stayed really solid, which is beautiful to see, you know, because I think just as much as everything's losing its shit, it's kind of hard and it's an exceptional moment. It's like a bit hard to predict how things will go down, you know, but like just those moments of being like, okay, the space, the door got kicked off, the space is trashed, but people are just going to like hang out there all the time. We're going to do our meals there. We're going to spend nights there. We're going to fix the space together. Okay, like the space is being like physically attacked by these like heads. People are going to just like flow out to do it. They're going to like take physical risks. They're going to be brave. They're going to publicly stand for extremely unpopular ideas. So there was an element in which it was beautiful, even though it was, it was very exaggerated, the moment that we lived through.
For sure. The space, there's a lot of things. Just going to say the space got several firebombing threats, and in the end that led to us getting evicted. But we actually ended up finding a much better and larger space than we had before, so it worked out quite well despite the stress.
You know, in the United States now, there's talk, two senators, including Ted Cruz, who's pretty well known, you know, tried to run for president, have put forward this, you know, Antifa equals domestic terror resolution, which is, you know, non-binding, but, you know, certainly not a good thing. They're trying to propose that. I'm just curious, I mean, would you have any advice in terms of, you know, when politicians are really kind of seizing on this moment and really putting forth these really grandiose things like, you know, the Circle A is a hate crime, you know, all this stuff. Do you feel like people did anything really well that kind of pushed back on that? Or was it just kind of, as time went on, just the news cycle just kind of dropped it out of people's view? Or,
I mean, one thing that I felt like was important here and that ended up serving us really well for the kind of next round of repression was refusing to go back and hide within the left. That we really insisted on like what's specific about anarchists. We insisted on the most unpopular parts of our politics and just like doubled down every single time. And I know that can be really hard. And I think sometimes maybe you've got to like gauge the situation and see how far you're willing for things to go. And I think we were willing to deal with the kinds of things that happened to us. But I think sometimes one of the consequences of repression is that you lose some of what you build, right? And just, I think as anarchists, we work a lot in order to have like an anarchist practice and to be able to have like autonomy from these kind of more recuperative social forces or spaces that don't represent our ideas very well. Right. So I think we actually lose something much worse than what repression can take from us when we give up that ground.
Totally. I think too, kind of going on what Cedar was saying that, the Lock Street, what happened on Lock Street was wildly unpopular, and there was really intense backlash from like both the right and the state, and also like people within sort of closer social circles. So we sort of had different levels, but while we continued to like stick by those actions and try to explain them and put them into context and like defend those things instead of trying to distance ourselves, part of that was also continuing to do the various projects and organizing that we already do in the city, mm-hmm. and trying to sort of contextualize that as like also part of like anarchist struggle and just like continuing to do that and having more conversations with people. And instead of going inwards, trying to really continue to have an outward focus. I think the other part of that that has continued to be a focus for us here, obviously like the like state policy or municipal politics or whatever, that's not our concern. But when there's been conversations of sort of equating anarchism with terrorism, or most recently a lot of rhetoric about, you know, the far left and the far right, they're just like the exact same, you know, they're just extremists. Trying to really have conversations with people and try really hard to sort of challenge that narrative and talk about actually why those things are fundamentally different and why it's a problem to equate them and what some of the results are.
Yeah. And I feel people took it a couple different ways to do that, you know, because I feel like with the hate crimes thing, instead of saying focus on the real hate crimes, you say like this entire discourse is garbage. It is just another tool that the state uses to create sort of states of exception around certain people that can then expose them to more violence. And terrorism is a little bit similar. I feel like there's a temptation to want to maintain the category of terrorist to just keep yourself out of it, you know? So I think there's a way to just push back against that and be like, terrorism is a racist category that the state uses to just make it safe to kill people, essentially. Another way of looking at it, though, is that like terrorism is a coherent political strategy that people who are often have garbage politics and are horrible will choose to use. And anarchists have consistently rejected it for 100 years, you know, so it's just literally false to say that anarchists are terrorists. It just doesn't stand up to any kind of the definitions or histories.
Yeah. I mean, it also begs the question of, you know, what is the center's position when the, you know, neoliberalism and, quote, the center have brought us to everything that we're dealing with today.
Yeah, exactly.
Okay, well, just moving on. So that's kind of the context in which, you know, what we're going to be talking next has been kind of playing out for.
The other context was there was a bunch of us who were facing charges.
Yeah.
And are still picking up sentences.
That's
true. Yeah.
We both had conspiracy charges. I got out of jail 3 months before going back to jail.
Lots of stuff has already been said about it. I think it just very much frames sort of a lot of things that's happened with Pride and moving forward, and how those, like, those charges and that context have, like, really shaped a lot of stuff here.
Well, let's just get into the events of Pride and what happened afterwards. So leading up to Pride, was there any kind of rumblings that this was going to be something big? Or what did people think, you know, going into Pride, what was going to happen, if anything?
Right. I mean, people definitely thought something was going to happen. So the sort of random hodgepodge of far right figures who come and disrupt Pride. This isn't the first year. Like, it's something they do annually and had done last year with Hamilton Pride in a different way. A few weeks prior to Hamilton Pride this year, there was another Pride celebration in Dunnville, which is a smaller town fairly close to us, and they showed up again and disrupted it. And this year, people were remarking that it was, like, particularly bad. They're particularly aggressive and sort of did this thing where they would sort of latch on to, like, one individual and just, like, start attacking them personally and, like, making really disgusting comments about, you know, them being, like, raped when they're kids and that's why they're gay and just, like, really gross stuff. So definitely the idea was they had come to Hamilton last year, they will do it again. And based on the Pride in Dunnville, they were probably going to be more forward and a little more aggressive than they had been in the past.
Mm-hmm. There's an element that was surprising still, which is just that there's sort of this, like, specifically religious far right that has maybe done those things, but that's the sort of more alt-righty nationalist far right typically is atheist. And so I think it just has was a little bit of an open question about how much that would be a thing as well. Cause it'd been sort of these weekly far right demos that had been happening in Hamilton, and mostly it was just like a handful of wingnuts and people could ignore them. But then the odd time, all the different kind of soldiers of whatever, proud of whatever groups would come and back them up, and then things could get really violent and dangerous, but it would be unpredictable. But that momentum had kind of been happening in Hamilton as well, right? So it was, I think the thing that happened at Pride was that those kind of specifically religious groups that had already been doing this homophobic thing, and these people who were just interested in going around and, like, fighting leftists or something, like, came together in, like, kind of a limited way and made a more dangerous situation.
Yeah, I think because people thought something might happen, folks started to get together and sort of have some more explicit conversations to strategize of how to potentially intervene and deal with that at Pride. So the decision or plan that folks came up with was just to construct a really large, reinforced fabric black barrier that would just be, like, basically held in front of the group. They had usually come with these, like, ginormous, like, 6-foot massive signs and stuff while they're, like, hurling insults at people. So the initial goal was just trying to, like, feel like fairly defensive, just to, like, block them away from, like, the main Pride events.
So yeah, let's get into talking about what actually happened at Pride. And I think a lot of people definitely need to know, you know, what the police did and didn't do there at the confrontation.
Right. So early on in Pride, the mismatched group of sort of the same religious fundamentalists and, like, some, like, local neo-Nazis and yellow vesters and stuff showed up. The group of people who were doing the stuff with the wall went to block them out. Didn't take very long. Things, like, escalated pretty quickly. They first got there, they were, like, had their big sign, had, like, a megaphone, and were just, like, yelling different stuff at people and, like, not surprisingly, but also, like, really grossly, like, you know, picking on and really like emphasizing like folks in the crowd who are like visibly like racialized, or, you know, be yelling anti-gay slurs at the same time as like yelling for people to go back to their own country or some bullshit like that. But very quickly a scuffle, some shoving happened, and basically a brawl sort of broke out between, the folks who were holding the banner, the right wing that was there, and then actually very quickly, like, a bunch of just general, like, pride goers who were in and around got involved. So probably lasted, it's always hard to say how long something like that lasts. I would say it went on for like 15 minutes to like half an hour in sort of different starts and bursts of people scuffling. During that time, the police didn't intervene in any way. Not that that would have been something that we would have advocated or asked for anyways. But the police didn't intervene at all. They eventually did come, but after the fight had mostly stopped. One of the first things that they did when they got there was going up to the people who are holding the banner who are wearing pink masks and trying to demand that they take their masks off in front of like the fascists and things like that. Obviously people refused. They stood around for a little bit, kind of breaking up the two crowds of people. And then shortly after, they just escorted the far right folks out of the park where Pride was being held.
Yeah. And it followed on this sort of slow building controversy throughout a lot of the prides in Canada that have been going on for a few years, like, I guess like 3 years ago, that Black Lives Matter people in Toronto, did like a really good kind of intervention in an attempt to kind of push Pride to exclude the police from participating in the parade, whether through community policing or through just like having a kind of block of uniformed cops marching in the parade. And that kind of controversy comes up every single year, because every single year the police try to get themselves like invited back. And so Hamilton had kind of followed that line and had excluded the police from running this sort of like recruiting booth that they've often tried to have. And so even while things were going on, the police were making comments to people that somewhat along the lines of like, this is what happens when you don't invite us. And afterwards, that was pretty much the tone as well. Like the police chief got on the radio and was saying like, well, if only Pride people had welcomed us there, then maybe we would have been able to defend them, you know? And so just being very kind of clear about their choice to allow kind of homophobic violence to occur, for their political goal of like forcing the kind of queer community to accept their presence, which in some ways is fine. Cause like, honestly, we'd rather settle our own scores and we'd rather like fight our own battles, you know? And so it's more just like a question of like how to do that and how to do without them. So I think a lot of the conversation since then has been like, well, like if self-defense is where we're going to be, then let's like figure out how to do it in the best way we can and to do it on our own terms as much as possible, you know? And in some ways, it's like a scary conversation, but it's also like a beautiful one that involves talking about the ways that we're strong. And I think the more we're able to have that conversation, the more we're able to kind of thwart what the cops are trying to do to push their way back into spaces that they've been excluded from.
Yeah, I mean, generally the police sort of public relations, community relations, whatever, just seem to really deal with the situation horribly, much to our benefit. But Cedar mentioned, yeah, publicly just said that basically, you get what you deserve, sort of mentioned that it's actually the organizers of Pride who are maybe responsible for the far right attack. They had said to the press that like Pride, they didn't know what was going to happen, and they didn't, like no one from the Pride organizers had talked to them or anything. But it came out later, and the Pride organizers, it's not a very radical group. Like it's pretty sort of like mainstream liberalish sort of thing, but they had like a long sit down meeting with the police the week before Pride talking about what happened in Dunnville and their concerns for Pride. So this sort of started a pretty large cascade in the city of sort of like a lot of just general like public anger towards the police on a level that I think we've really seen in Hamilton before. I mean, a lot of this unfortunately like went with the like, you know, I can't believe the police did that. They're supposed to protect us, or, you know, we just need better police or like more queer police or that sort of thing. But still with a lot of like conversations of people, even if they want better police, saying that, like, they don't trust the police and they can't expect any times in the near future to feel comfortable with the Hamilton police, even if generally being anti-police isn't their politics.
Yeah, create an interesting space.
Yeah.
Yeah, there was a couple similar situations in the United States, especially in Detroit, where the police basically marched in a neo-Nazi group that had marched in Charlottesville, and they had, like, full swastika flags on. And they were actually on the podcast before, and the feeling that they had was not only was there a lot of revulsion and anger at the police, but the anti-fascist and the small black bloc that was there was really kind of held up by the people as, like, the group that, like, defended the larger space. And I'm curious, you know, was, on top of the anger at the police, was there kind of a turning within, I mean, obviously you can only generalize so much, but I mean, was there a turning in some people's perspectives towards the anarchists and the anti-fascists that were there in masks fighting?
I mean, maybe not right away, because I think at first people were accurately saying that, like, the folks who defended Pride were just people in the neighborhood and, like, Pride attendees, you know, which is true, that I think there was a desire to not appear as, like, a separate group, you know, and I think in some ways, yeah, I think in some ways that was, like, that's definitely still the case, you know. I think you kind of get produced as a separate group through oppression, though, which didn't take very long to fall, because I guess so you have the situation where the police are being heavily critiqued, and then you have these politicians and cops who are trying to fall back on this narrative of, like, oh, the kind of violence on many sides type discourse. So they need to produce this, like, other side, right? And so one way they do that is by trying to look closely at individuals who are there and seeing who they can go after. So we're in a context where a lot of people in Hamilton have various kinds of, like I was on parole, other people are on probation or have various kinds of, like, court orders over them. And so it's very easy for the cops to go after people when they're flailing around trying to look like they're in control of a situation, right? And trying to frame the other side as being something that is, like, you know, just as dangerous as the, like, fascists who came. And one of the interesting things is that it just didn't work for them. Like, I think they were still thinking about Lock Street, in which, like, the entire city hated us and didn't expect that they couldn't just, like, arrest me or, like, arrest other people and hold us up as being these, like, violent hooligans and just get away with whatever they wanted to. You know, it was actually, like, people understood from the content of the acts and the fact that we're, like, you know, not separate from, like, the queer community that, yeah, I don't know. What do you think?
I mean, I think some people would still see us as separate. I think there's a lot, obviously, the queer community, like any community, is super heterogeneous and, you know, there's lots of, like, positions on this. But do you think in general, the sort of city-wide, like, perception and interaction with, like, anarchists in general or whatever, like, really did start to shift quite quickly? And in the beginning, like, both the city and the police actively tried to push the narrative of this isn't about the far right, just about these, like, riotous, violent anarchists. They're the same ones who broke things at Lock Street. They're just agitators. Like, it's all about that. And I'm actually sort of surprised to see how little traction that they got with that argument. And very quickly, people just was like, that has nothing to do with this. So that was interesting to see. And then I think as things have progressed, for better or worse, the police and the city have handled things, which say, like, quite poorly in a way that has actually, like, worked to our advantage in many ways and how they've dealt with the situation. So in the weeks following the events at Pride, the first three people they arrested were all anarchists who were supposed to be on the pink mask side or whatever. And then they went on to arrest more anarchists in relation to some of the other actions that had took place in Hamilton. So on the day of action that we organized, some folks just did a really sort of, like, kind of whimsical action at the mayor's home, put some lawn signs up that just said, "Mayor doesn't care about queer people," well, like some folks dressed up sort of masquerade style played awful, kind of like horrendous music in the morning, like lasted for 10 minutes. And then like everyone left, it sort of went off. Like no one thought it was a big deal. But quickly following that, the mayor just sort of lost and immediately was like on Twitter and talking to the news about this like attack on him and his family, and talking about how this was like a citywide priority. And then you had the police talking about how they're taking this very seriously and are going to like pursue everyone to the fullest extent of the law. 5 hours after the action, one person was arrested the day of on set like 4 or 5 charges, criminal harassment, disruption, different things like that. And then the following week, they arrested another person in relation to the lawn signs, whatever incident, another person who's facing assault charges for allegedly hitting one of the folks on the right. And through all of this, and somewhere in the middle, they just arrested one single person who's accused of being on the Pride protesters, those who are protesting Pride. So I think optics-wise and people feeling rightfully frustrated, it was very obvious that the city and the police weren't really taking seriously or really caring about the rise of the right in the city or like what happened at Pride, and were very much targeting other folks. And I think too, there was the right folks take a lot of videos of things that they do. They took tons of video of the event at Pride and, you know, proudly posted online, but it's just tons of video evidence of them assaulting people, and some people were fairly hurt. So there's a general public outcry, like, why aren't you arresting anybody? Like, you have all this evidence, like, everyone can see it. And one of the main sort of perpetrators of that violence went to Pride in Toronto the following week and also assaulted people and posted video of it on the internet. So we're getting frustrated that no one was getting arrested. And then you go and you have some people put lawn signs up on a lawn, and all of a sudden the day of, people are getting arrested. Their whole narrative before that, you know, these things take time. The police have to gather evidence. You can't just, you know, throw charges up immediately, sort of threw out the window when the mayor's woken up in the morning to some bad music.
It's also the way people chose to like take sides too, which is kind of cool. Cause I think one of the things that the police really tried to emphasize, and but that is also true, is that none of the people who were attacked by the far right or who defended themselves at Pride that day gave them any statements. Like nobody ratted. And I think that was just part of this thing too. So the police and the city were left in this role where if they were going to intervene in this situation at all, and they're of course going to do it clumsily, but if they do, it's going to be really hard for them to like end up on that other side or something. Like almost anything that they can do to look like they're in control of the situation is going to be siding with Nazis, you know? And which is just like a good place to put them in, honestly. And a good place to, because just the actions of defending Pride like really spoke for itself, and their ability to like delegitimate people fell apart almost immediately, like Tammy is saying. So it did just leave a lot of space to like talk about those actions and then have a more interesting conversation about like the appropriateness of like defending yourself and what are the consequences of like not of excluding the police, you know? Because either if you don't trust the cops, and that's a thing we can all agree on, then either you've got to try to change the police so you can trust them, or you've got to try to figure out what a world without them looks like. So I don't know, just I feel like the way that lines ended up getting drawn just made for a better conversation than has happened other times.
Gonna have
I'm hoping now we can kind of talk about what happened specifically with Cedar. And from our understanding, you know, you were not at the demonstration or not at the Pride event, and that the reason the police arrested you was that you had given a speech at a city council or some sort of like city function.
Yeah.
Before the Pride demonstrations had even taken place. And, this kind of, you know, WTF-ness of the whole police action, you know, spurred what we're going to talk about the rest of the program. But I'm just curious if you can just kind of lay out for us what exactly happened. And also, like, when the police did come to get you, what did they say anything like, we're getting you for your speech, you know? What did they say?
Well, all right, so the Pride thing happened first, and then 3 days later, I think, there was this kind of public meeting that had been called by the LGBTQ, whatever, advisory committee to the city council. So everything was really stirred up already, and because of what had happened at Pride, people were feeling a lot of anger, I think. And so that committee had already called this meeting in advance to deal with like a different set of issues relating to how the city doesn't care about queer people. But they sort of just changed their agenda to make space to talk about what had happened at Pride as well. So I'd stayed home from the Pride thing because, like I said, people had a good idea that stuff was going to happen. And I was actually trying to just make it through my parole without any problems, you know? But I was feeling really intense, just like guilt and rage, just like watching people I love, like come home hurt from this thing. And I was also feeling really proud of people because people had like held the space. They had like defended the park. They like ran those people off, you know? And yeah. And so I was like, well, I don't know. One thing that feels like it honors those feelings is to just go to this meeting and like try to just talk honestly about the situation. Yeah. So it was really, I don't know. It was kind of a standard meeting, the kind of thing you'd expect to happen in City Hall, where just like a bunch of people who have official roles are like sitting in the middle and everybody else is around them. And there's like speakers lists and you take your turn. It was very orderly. But there was like a deputy police chief and the head of the hate crimes unit who were in the room. It turns out the organizer of the meeting had asked them to leave and they had refused. Because I guess the organizers wanted people to be able to actually talk about things honestly.
But they reassured that they were there to listen and learn and build better community relationships.
Because they're so humble and they just want to be good. but yeah, I guess when that agenda item came up, I just talked about how it's important to support the folks who defended the space, even if it was like a scary situation, about how if we don't want cops around, we have to like prepare ourselves to use force if necessary. And how, you know, that of course we'd all love to be peaceful, but our choice to do that is only meaningful if we have the ability to be violent. And then, yeah, more or less, I guess, tried to get the people in the room to throw at the police. Which like, you know, people yelled at the cops to leave, but like nobody got up to like rush them or anything like that, you know, and sat back down. The meeting went on. And then a couple days later, we started hearing about how the police had been sniffing around with warrants, trying to arrest people who'd been at Pride. And I didn't think it had to do with me, because I hadn't been there. But so we went up, some people kind of put together leaflets and went to this like anti-hate rally that had been called, just to leaflet against repression of Pride defenders. And ended up getting arrested there while handing out these anti-repression leaflets. And the cops who arrested me were just like, oh, do you know you have a warrant? And I was like, what is it for? And they're like, we have no idea. And it's just, your parole's pulled. We don't know why. Yeah, and yeah, I didn't find out why until like 4 days later. All of it's been very mysterious. The communication around what has been going on has been very strange, which is fine. I mean, they just have the power to do what they want, and so they do what they want. But yeah, I think it's one of those ones, again, like Tammy is saying, it just they just handled everything so badly, you know, to just like arrest me in the middle of like a crowd of 100 people who are already out there protesting the way that the cops let fascists attack Pride, and to have me be the first person to get arrested, I think is just, it's just terrible optics. It was kind of, I was almost laughing while it was happening.
Well, the other thing is that I distinctly remember the original media framing was that, you know, you were there at the demonstration and like trying to make it logical sense. Like you were there, it was violence, you were on probation for doing something else, so therefore you, but then it kind of came out and then people were like, oh, this person wasn't there, but yet they were arrested.
It's just a flimsy lie, as far as I can tell. Like, the documents that the police sent to my parole officer didn't mention attendance at the demonstration. They only mentioned the speech and that I had, like, attacked them personally and they felt threatened.
Yeah, in the media, it really backfired. The police, like, definitely went very, very hard with the narrative that Cedar was at Pride and that's where they were arrested. But really quickly after the arrest, sort of, a statement was released explaining that they weren't there. You know, people who are there should be defended, but in this case, like, Cedar just wasn't there. And as the police, like, pushed that more and more, really largely, actually got, like, a lot, like, several, both, like, affidavits to provide for Cedar's parole hearing, but also people coming forth in the media who are generally, like, respectable people in the community, like, folks who have sort of more professional jobs in the local queer community here, a really well-known previous city councilor who's now running for provincial politics, like, even put through a statement of just like, I know Cedar, I was at Pride, like, they weren't there. So more and more that came forward. Nonetheless, the police continued to assert, no, absolutely, they were absolutely there. Basically never really stepped away from that, even after sort of evidence, like, was released and, like, released to the press saying that they weren't there. And it had very little to do with that, but they still sort of went with, like, well, they might have been there. That's really what was going on. And just sort of tried to stop talking about it and kind of, like, jump around having to answer any questions about that.
And we're going to talk about kind of, like, what happened after that. But just to be clear, even, like, applying their own rules to themselves, I mean, you know, you didn't do anything wrong, obviously, by giving a speech at a city council meeting. I mean, you know, you are within your legal rights.
I guess so. I mean,
countersue them or something. I mean, like, you know, this is.
We'll see. I mean, I don't think so. The parole hearing essentially ruled that people on parole have no rights and have no expectation to be able to participate in public space, which is horrible. There's, like, a lot of people on life parole. Like, there's people who are our friends who are on parole forever and are just now. There's this, like, ruling on the books that they can't speak or participate in even, like, the most democratic channels.
The parole board literally told you that. Basically, because you made the police feel unsafe with your speech, that you then they could take your rights away and throw you back in jail.
Absolutely. That's exactly what they said. They said that the issue was that the members of the public, so in this case cops, they had the perception of there being an undue risk that the peace was about to be disturbed. So they said the peace was not disturbed, but there was a perception of a risk that it might be. Very low bar.
Well, that's a great vision of society. We thought that he might have a gun. We didn't know, but he could have. There's no way of knowing that he didn't, so we shot him.
Watching thought there was a risk, so.
Also interesting because so much of the response, so the mainstream response really from the city is just like, people just need to come to city council, just need to speak in meetings. Like, this is a place to work things out. So you have, you know, Cedar goes to a meeting, speaks, and gets arrested. And then the two people who are arrested in relation to the lawn signs, one of their conditions is that they can't be on the premises of City Hall or be within, like, a certain distance of the mayor. So everyone's just like, you just need to go through the proper channels. And, like, literally people are, like, banned from even going anywhere near that.
That's great. Cause...
Yeah, which is good. So as people are becoming more critical of the police, also people are all of a sudden becoming much more critical of, like, city council and local politics and just being like, okay, we clearly can't rely on this, so we need to talk about other things, which is, you know, always nice.
Yeah. Wow. And in some ways, like, recuperation is harder to deal with than repression in some ways. Like, repression is straightforward. It's, like, brutal and hard, but you can, like, kind of figure out how to get through it, you know, but repression is, like, recuperation is more slippery. It's harder to pin down. So just being in a context where they're so bad at it and just missing every time they're just, like, invited to do the right thing and just failing, you know, is just, it's convenient.
Okay, so you're taken away for the crime of going to a city council meeting. And then what follows is that, you know, hashtag Free Cedar grows. As you said, there was a demonstration outside of the mayor's house, which is hilarious. I mean, there's like, what, 20 people there, and the mayor was freaking out. And, I mean, I don't know if you all saw this, but, like, the tweets, like, the mayor sent out a tweet, like, you know, like...
Oh, yeah.
Mask hoodlums outside my house. They have lawn signs and, like, literally it was like one of those things where it gets, like, retweeted, like, maybe 100 times, but then there's, like, 5,000 comments, like, mayor. Or,
oh yeah,
like you sure. suck, or you know, just like, you know, why are you afraid of your constituents like coming to your house to talk about what's going on, or you know, whatever. But I'm just curious if you can kind of talk about that initial kind of explosion of solidarity. I mean, there was a day of action that was called that was very successful. Cities participating. There was mass marches. You know, lots of people across Canada were standing up and taking action. Lots of anarchist groups. Looks like a lot of like queer and trans folks, especially like a lot of the young people. From what I understand, a lot of people that like they had never gone to a demonstration before. We've talked to a couple other people from up your way about this, and that was kind of their take on it. So I'm just curious if you can just talk about that explosion and what it was like.
Yeah, I think one of the things that we really try to do a lot here and like really value is repression happens. It's something that we always have to deal with, but really in the face of repression, instead of stopping organizing, just to really step up organizing and start going even harder to sort of like put this like face of resiliency and push back against things. So in the morning, Cedar got arrested directly, like maybe an hour after that, there was a call out for a demonstration outside of the main police station that eventually went to march to the jail that Cedar was being held. For like 200 people there, only a couple hours notice, which Hamilton isn't a super large place. So that was a good sign. And then just from there, sort of every day started to organize, little things, called for International Day of Action. I think things happened in 50 cities, not 500. I don't think we're quite that popular, but 50 was still amazing and so, so great.
I say 500, I meant 50.
Oh yeah, it's like 500, that's a lot, 50.
Next time.
Yeah, we put the call out. It was only with 3 days notice because we wanted to sort of continue, just to really put pressure on things here. So we weren't sure how it would go, but I think all of us were like amazed and really like touched and heartened by like how in 3 days, like various like anarchist networks and things that we're connected to different places, like just were so effective of like coming together and organizing things so quickly in a way that, yeah, definitely surprised us and was like a really beautiful thing to see so much going on and people responding to that. And here we organized a large night demo. It ended in like a dance party with fireworks that shut down the largest like intersection in the city, which we've never been able to do before. That's sort of like a new thing for Hamilton. So that was like great. And as you mentioned, it was nice to see there was a lot of sort of like younger, sort of newer folks there. And that was like, I also heard from people that was like their first demo and it was, you know, really like anti-police and explicitly like anti-state and just took over the downtown of the city for a period of time. And it was, I think it would end up being something that leads to more people being involved in different stuff here in the future, which is always great.
Yeah, I love my friends. They have great reflexes and are like super fucking persistent. It's a beautiful thing. Like, I think sometimes when, I don't know, we live in a context that's like pretty peaceful usually, you know, and it feels like a really big uphill battle to build up kind of contestation, to build up kind of radical energy, to like spread practices and ideas that are subversive with others. But then in moments when things accelerate, it's like you really see the fruit of all that work, right? Like having those networks to draw on, having those like deep affinities and trust with the people in your life. Like, yeah, I was in a communication black hole for like about a week, you know, and then during that time I had like zero doubt, but that like my good buds were doing amazing stuff and that they'd be saying things that I was comfortable with and just like putting forward strong analysis and like not backing down. And I'd see fireworks outside the jail and people would like eventually figure out and be able to come and visit me and figure out phone stuff and, you know, just and covering all of these bases, you know, and being able to really make the most of those moments that you ran into. And I think it's just good to remember that even when things feel slow and hopeless, that the infrastructure and the strength and the capacity that you build together is what's going to let you make the most of the moments when things change really quickly.
I wanted to ask specifically about kind of the role of the queer and the trans community within this. I mean, however we want to define that or talk about it. was that like a very large part of this? Did it like kind of become radicalized in a certain way, or what were the dynamics at play within that?
Good question, and difficult to answer to an extent, obviously, because just like how is a community defined? Like, who are we talking about? But definitely was involved and definitely led to some polarizing moments and some like really hard conversations that in the past, when we've tried to broach different conversations, people really wouldn't have them. But all of a sudden these conversations were being had and people were forced into a situation where they had to take a stand on. And I don't think I've ever seen so many people like in a really quick period of time, like really having radicalized positions on like a pretty decent scale. So all of a sudden, you know, before, if we were to argue about why you wouldn't want police at Pride or what, like that would be controversial. It wasn't always a given that the police wouldn't be at Pride. Like that was still an ongoing debate here in Hamilton. And now I can't imagine it's going to take them years to try to build back up the relationship. They're not going to be like welcome anywhere near Pride. Beyond that, same thing with city council previously, you know, try to make arguments about how like you can't rely on like change or things you want to come from like established politics, whether it's like municipal politics or beyond that, that you have to be like dealing with the problems in your own community and working to solve them. All of a sudden that didn't sound so crazy to folks, and people were starting to say that and wanting to have those conversations. I think the last point that happened that was really beneficial, the last couple of years, there's always been lots of, so in Hamilton, like most places, there's been like a rise of the right here, and then organizing, doing demonstrations and stuff. And there's been a lot of calls from people more on the liberal left that we just need more like hate crime legislation or hate related bylaws or stuff like that in the city that will like deal with this issue. Which we've always been like, no, like what you need to do is organize against them, like building power is what will confront them. And beyond that, you might have good intentions, but it's most likely that these like hate legislations and things that you're asking for aren't going to be used in the way you think they're going to be used. And they're much more likely to be used against sort of like left-leaning activists than those on the right. And with this, the city put forward weeks ago their plan to deal with the right. Their sort of like plan to address hate with all these sort of like supposed to be like hate bylaws and stuff in the city. And the list that they outlined was ridiculous. And it was basically everything. None of the activities that it talked about were really things that the like far right groups had done in the city, but mostly like anarchists and others. So it was like, you know, you can't hand out water at an event. You can't hand out leaflets. You can't have any amplified noise. You can't like walk on the streets. You can't like, you can't like sidewalk chalk. You couldn't chalk on anything. You couldn't like, it's a long, long, ridiculous list. And I think very quickly it was obvious that who that was focusing on had nothing to do with the right. And that started more conversations with people sort of seeing like, okay, actually that's not where those problems will get solved. So that's been nice.
Along the edges of the endless road.
Is it fair to say that Cedar being out now is due to the pressure and just the situation as it is?
I mean, maybe. I everything was just super opaque. Like, I had this parole hearing, and then usually the parole board decides in like half an hour what the decision is, but instead they waited 5 days, and I never received the ruling. Like, my lawyer eventually got it, and he like read me a piece of it over the phone, and then they let me out on an entirely random day that had nothing to do with the parole board's ruling. Like, it was 2 weeks earlier. I have no idea. I have no idea what happened. Like, I still never have gotten a good answer. I got let out with 24 hours notice. It's possible that like pressure just resulted in some like bureaucrat just not sending a document or not inputting something. It's possible that because the situation had so much pressure around it that their decision to go for 5 days and send it up their hierarchy meant that their usual process broke down and they were just more likely to mess up. But yeah, it doesn't really make sense. I think making situations more complicated for them and making yourself tougher to just like swallow into the system though, has benefits in like tons of different ways, right? And that even if I hadn't gotten out, that being inside for a situation that has like clear politics that you can like explain to people and that people are largely sympathetic with, you know, like, made my time easier too and gives you kind of like a relationship of force or strength relative to the institution where things are, they're less likely to mess with you. So even if it hadn't kind of possibly resulted in me freeing up 2 weeks early, it's like that kind of campaign definitely has like real practical benefits to people who are inside.
Did the guards or anybody involved in the institution give you any flack for who you were, or just, you know, built up a bit of a reputation for yourself at this point?
My goodness, it's a little bit ridiculous. I mean, this is like my fifth time going in, and yeah, I mean, when in the Hamilton jail, I'm treated like with extreme caution. Like, they just keep me in segregation. I think in part because they're just worried about anything happening to me and that being a huge problem for them. And then in part because they're worried about the security of the place because there is often so much solidarity. And for better or for worse, like, the anarchists are considered like extremely scary. Like, there's regular attempts to like have us be considered terrorists. Right. And we've just been extremely persistent. Like, the jail has been a site of struggle for like 10 years, you know, like people just passed the 10-year anniversary of doing like at least once annual kind of combative noise demos outside of the jail. So yeah, there is this like existing relationship of antagonism, prisoners in the jail kind of know broadly who the anarchists are and some of what we stand for, you know, and it's just, we're like embedded in those neighborhoods. So there is that, you know. I feel like I got the odd kind of bonehead guard who, you know, one time while we were, because there's searches that happen all the time because fentanyl now. And so one time while I was out getting searched, I came back and there was just some like hostile graffiti on the wall from like whatever guards had been searching the cell, and had another time where just like some like big white guy just came over and like woke me up and just like made some very kind of threatening remarks. But like, mostly it's not a big deal, and I feel like those are just isolated individuals, you know, and that you can't necessarily prevent that from happening.
What was it like to get out and just see the level of support and action and everything?
I mean, I have a lot of feelings. I think it's really good to show people that if they take risks and have something bad happen, that people will have their back, right? And that people will gather around them and they will like defend their actions. They will defend their ideas. They'll be personally supported. I think, yeah, there's a good critique that exists in the kind of anarchist space that's beginning heard more and more about just like prisonerism, and that a lot of the time we really value anonymity, right? And one of the reasons for that is because we don't want to create sort of like public figures necessarily. But an exception that often happens is for prisoners or for people facing repression. And part of that is because the politics around solidarity intersect with the needs for like practical support and building specific campaigns that even sometimes anarchists who don't like to make demands will end up making demands for freedom and for charges to be dropped, which is essentially just demanding the state to concede. So there is this bit of an exception that's existed, and there is a critique around that, that it reproduces some of what we don't want and some of what we tried to avoid it through anonymity. So I feel like that's just a line that people here are like aware of, that it's a conversation that people have, you know, and made the choice that they made. And I think it was a good choice, and it's one that I'm like grateful for. It's just, yeah, it's also complicated. It's like a funny role to be in. So now to be going and like doing interviews and kind of continuing that trajectory is like, I don't know, it's not obvious. I probably won't keep doing it, but I'm grateful to just have this moment to talk to kind of to you folks and other people just about what's been going on here and share some ideas. It feels productive for now.
I think, unfortunately, too, some things are just, like, outside of people's control. They're, like, actually, like, a lot of, like, intention and care was put into, like, obviously, you know, promoting, like, things to do with, like, solidarity with CEDAR and really, like, pushing that, but also talking about the broader context in Hamilton, the other folks facing charges, talking about, like, other defenders, and also at the same time trying to not exceptionalize anyone facing charges and sort of talk about how it's not about exceptional individuals, but, like, much bigger struggles going on here and, you know, really, like, explicitly being, like, you know, CEDAR's wonderful and everything, but, like, they're, like, not a hero. They're just a person, like, any of us who can, like, do different things and get in different situations. But the way media just sort of runs with things, sometimes they sort of create their own sort of stories and really, like, you know, prefer that angle of the, like, exceptional individual regardless of what's being put out there.
That's for sure. And the state likes that too, right? Like, the state likes to generate ringleaders, have this belief that if they can, like, take out certain individuals that they can make things kind of crumble or something, which I think is just demonstrated not to be true. Yeah, so I think just that general message of just, like, support for all the defendants, not, dropping all charges, hostility to the police, support for all prisoners, destroy prisons. It's not about any one person.
Well, I was going to say, looking back now on things, are there any big lessons that you would, that you can see in terms of just, you know, kind of going into this moment where, you know, so much was just kind of flung open. And I'm just, you know, this, it seems like the situation was very much kind of like, you know, up for grabs and in people's favor in some ways, you know, despite all the repression, put in front of you. I'm just curious, you know, any grand lessons or are there any big questions that you all have that you still haven't kind of worked out?
About grand lessons, I think general sort of orientation or discussion that, like, we've had here a lot is how, like, repression, however, like, awful, and it always is in different ways, isn't, like, 100% totally, like, a negative thing. Mm-hmm. And even, like, you know, Lock Street last year, like, a lot of us faced charges, you know, didn't have the greatest sentences, dealt with, like, a lot of, like, scorn in the city, and we were really, like, exposed to, like, a pretty hostile environment. But even with that, like, we worked to sort of try to come up with some, like, benefits from that and things that we created through that. And, you know, in the end, despite how Lock Street was perceived, I think, like, anarchist struggle and anarchists in Hamilton were in a stronger place afterwards than they were beforehand. So I think when it comes to stuff going on with Pride now, that's an even easier argument to make. So you can, like, quickly see how things are shifting politically. And I think when we began to see the sort of opportunity, just wanted acknowledging that these opportunities don't always present themselves and they're not necessarily something you can create. There's something that sometimes just sort of come up, and that while it was happening, really tried to, like, okay, how far can we push this? How much can we do? We should try to, like, go as hard as we can and do as much as we can while we have this moment, because it's not going to last. So let's try to push things as much as we can now.
Yeah. Repression and dealing with repression is just central, I guess, to our politics in this town here. And partly it's just because, like, the fact that we're still around after, like, 10 or 15 years is because we've been able to, like, build up an analysis and build up some shared practice around these things, because otherwise we would have just gotten our asses kicked too many times over and over again. But I think it's also very clarifying, right? Like, one of the things that we got out of Lock Street, one of those positives, was that dealing with repression and getting through it gives a certain kind of clarity about what's specific about anarchism, what makes it distinct from forms of, like, progressivism, clarifies the nature of, like, the conflict that we're engaged in, one in which we are actually cultivating, like, hostility and antagonism towards something very powerful, right? And it's because we, like, carry a beautiful idea that fundamentally different forms of social relations are possible and desirable, and that therefore you're going to end up sooner or later coming up against the guardians of the existing world, you know? And I think that when we're facing repression and facing it bravely, which I think is important, that, like, it becomes a space to actually talk about things on that more fundamental level, right? Separately from any kind of particular issue, it clarifies the nature of the conflict and the nature of authority and gives people a chance to take sides in some like pretty stark ways.
I think in terms of questions moving forward, a big one that is like an immediate thing that we're thinking about is obviously, you know, it's great that now people are critical of the police and want to have conversations of what do you do instead of calling the police. It's great that folks don't want to go through city council anymore, want to like work at things more at the grassroots level, but what things? So I think like trying to not lose some of the momentum that has been built and trying to like move that into like actually like constructive and ongoing projects that are happening. So it's not just that people have developed, you know, a new critique, but a new critique and then starting to actually try to build different practices that are a response to that sort of more radical shift in people's politics.
Because it makes more things possible, right? Like one thing that I feel like I've been just really impressed by as I've been catching up on what was happening while I was gone is just how well people read the situation and were asking themselves like what's possible and pushing lots of different directions and just like personally feeling really surprised by just the kinds of things that folks were able to pull off and make happen, you know, because I think sometimes it's easy when you're kind of stuck in the day to day to just accept what appear to be the limitations of our context, you know, and I think just it's beautiful to see that people were able in this moment to like recognize that they're dealing with something different and to position themselves to take advantage of it.
Awesome. Where do you see things in your area going from here?
I feel like I've been away for like a long time. I've lived in Hamilton for 15 years, but in like the last 2 years, I've been here like 3 months because I just keep on getting pulled out of the city.
Yeah, I mean, I think obviously that's something we're always asking ourselves and isn't clear. I think we've like worked hard and have like developed a pretty visible anarchist presence in the city and have developed a lot of infrastructure and generally try to be like very social and outward oriented to sort of like always be trying to like bring more people in and stuff. And I think that is happening, and like our space project here is like more vibrant than it ever has been. There's like more and more new faces all of the time. But figuring out what to do with that is a big question, and also in a context where going back to sort of the Lock Street situation, it's rapidly, rapidly gentrifying the city. Mm-hmm. Like, used to be one of the cheapest places to live, like, in our area, and, like, rents have, like, at least quadrupled. And, like, currently our house, like, we're getting evicted, but it's very common. So every place that I've lived in Hamilton, I've got evicted because it's always getting sold to, like, new developers, and it's just money changing hands, sometimes for speculation, sometimes to, like, just raise the rents. But very few people here have stable housing, and it's really hard to find that. And as that gets worse, it impacts obviously like who's going to be here, and that's the question, like, who do you want to be organizing with? How do you want to be challenging that? And like, what does it mean when people's like material existence is becoming such a real struggle here?
Is there anything you want to say just before we sign off in terms of any legal updates? Are there things that people can do to support monetarily or anything else like that?
Yeah, so legal updates. So there are 5 people facing various charges in relation to this. Court stuff is sort of just starting out. Like, I think people have their first court dates this week. Unfortunately, fundraising for lawyers' fees is always a thing. The problem is it doesn't matter if these charges lead to anything, but the process as they drag it out can be really expensive, and I think is like, you know, intended to be a punitive punishment to us. So we spend way too much time paying lawyers, but we'll need lawyers for this so people can donate. But also, I just hate anarchist money and resources going into that. It's kind of the worst.
Yeah. God. One thing that's been beautiful throughout this, and it's great to just like see it continue and take different ways, is just people building practices of solidarity rather than just support. Like, support's important. Paying your people's lawyers is important. But just the ways that people have seen themselves reflected in the struggle and chosen to bring it to their own context and use it to kind of escalate and push things where they live, I think is like a beautiful part, you know? So
much better.
Much better. So like, yeah, just try to identify these like fault lines. What are the conflicts that exist with the police and the city where you live? What are the ways that like the far right is a specific threat to like communities that you're part of or adjacent to? And try and find ways to like dramatize these conflicts, push it forward, do it in reference to people in other places, build up like a strong front that can actually, yeah, present a viable kind of threat and alternative to these systems of authority.
This has been the It's Going Down podcast. Check itsgoingdown.org for daily updates, columns, action reports, and news. Go to itsgoingdown.org/shop to support us and follow us on all social media platforms. IGD, your daily resource for insurgent proletarian life.